Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 343, recorded Friday, April 20th, 2018. David Mickelson, founder of Snopes. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by FreshBooks. Join over 10 million people using FreshBooks to painlessly send invoices, track time, and capture expenses. Try it free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/triangulation. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? ZipRecruiter has revolutionized how you do it. Their technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply for your job. They find great candidates for you. Try it for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. Hello and welcome to another episode of Triangulation. I'm Jason Howell here at TWiT, and I love the show. We get to talk with some of the people that you may have heard about over the years in the world of technology, and I guarantee you've heard about this site called Snopes, right? That rings a bell. Snopes has been around for a very, very long time, cracking myths online. I have very early memories of my early days on the internet going to Snopes, because that's just, at some point along the line, that's where you hear from somebody else on the internet that you go when you hear something crazy and you want to find out whether it's real or not or true or not. You go to Snopes to debunk it. And we have joining us today as our awesome guest today, David Mickelson, who is the founder of Snopes, the guy behind Snopes from day one. How are you doing, David?
Good, thank you. Just say to follow on what you said, it's like I now have to realize when I'm speaking to audiences that I'm often talking to people who weren't born yet when I started the site.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really kind of crazy, because as I was kind of researching and getting ready for this interview, I was like, man, I have early memories of Snopes, but I don't remember exactly how early. I mean, I was on the internet in 1994, so it actually makes a whole lot of sense that Snopes is just one of those sites, one of those brands that I identify with the beginning days of the internet. And there you guys were, kind of paving the path before so many other sites. That's pretty, historically, that's pretty great.
Yes, before search engines even. Yeah, back in the days when Yahoo was still hand compiling directories to the web.
Absolutely. That's craziness. Yeah. So I figured, why don't we start off a little bit and talk about your background before we kind of, jump into Snopes as the site that we know now. And, it's gone through a lot of changes. The world has gone through a lot of changes over the years. But kind of heading back into your early days prior to Snopes, what was that like? Were you fascinated with technology when you were younger? Like, were there any indications from when you were younger that you might go on to, create a tool that was all about busting myths?
Well, I don't know about busting myths. I mean, I was, sort of interested in technology. I think I got my first Atari computer back in 1980 or so, which is kind of what spurred my interest in computers. And I eventually got a degree in computer science, and I worked for what was then a very large computer company. So back in the 80s, we were kind of on the internet before most people had heard of the internet, back in the days of Usenet news groups. Mm-hmm. And so like a lot of people, I was kind of fascinated with this world where you're interconnected with thousands of people all over the world, something kind of new to our experience, and kind of just stumbled across discussion groups that had to do with, I think the first two were Disney and Urban Legends, which had some intersection of their own. So after some years of that, kind of when the first graphical browser came out, I started just writing up, Disney-related legends, and had this little corner of the web. As I said, there were no search engines back then. I didn't hadn't used the Snopes domain name yet and didn't call the site Snopes. So that was the very rudimentary beginnings. And it just kind of took a left turn from where I expected. I mean, initially it was very focused on urban legends, very highly categorized. And it's a quickly became the place where everybody started sending everything they came across on the internet that was questionable. So it kind of moved away from being an encyclopedic reference to urban legends to just whatever was going on the internet, which back in the early days was a lot of computer virus warnings, most of which were hoaxes and missing child messages, most of which were hoaxes. And, surprisingly, looking back now, it was actually took quite a while before like things such as fake photos caught on. I mean, Photoshop was out there, but not as polished as it is now, not as many experienced users. So it was actually some years before we had to relegate photos to their own category. And even more surprisingly, in light of current events, it was quite a while before politics really took hold on the internet. Initially it was maybe, partisans flinging stuff back and forth. And, it took a while before campaigns really figured out how to use the internet as a tool. And then the last election, we had the added element of people completely not involved with U.S. politics, really, who figured out that they could make money off of it, like the infamous Macedonian teenagers entering the fray. So it's just very different and very much bigger than I had ever intended it to be.
Well, I mean, the reality is the world, not taking technology into consideration, the world changes in many ways in 20 years, which is basically what we're looking at here, right? 1994-ish, right around there versus where we are 2018. So let's say 24, almost 25 years, the world changes like crazy. And then you add technology into the mix. And I mean, these things, misinformation, hoaxes, it's so easy for this information to spread from one person to another. Whereas before, it was much more of a manual process. Person tells person. Person shares with one person. Now it's an easy broadcast, and everyone hears it. And it's really hard to understand what's true and what's not. That's the beauty behind Snopes. That's the mission.
I sometimes kid about back when we first started. Most things that were viral, if we could call them that, circulated by email. They were texts that people forwarded to one another, or even videos that people forwarded one to one another, because there were no YouTube, no video sharing. And it was kind of like we had weeks before things really built up to a critical viral point to track back where they came from and find out if they're true. And now, as you see, people post something like, say, on Facebook, like the incident at Starbucks. One person takes a video, posts it on the internet, and, 20 minutes later, it's a headline in the New York Post or something. There's no cook time anymore, really.
Absolutely.
The speed at which things move.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to imagine from facilitating the service that you do at Snopes, that applies a lot more pressure upon you guys. Like, back in 1994, when you were starting this, was there any sense of urgency to breaking these or debunking these hoaxes the way you have now? I have to imagine that it was nowhere nearly as urgent as it is now.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah, it wasn't. It's kind of interesting. There was a shift in, like, say, 2001 with the September 11 attacks, in that we were really, I think, pretty much the first organization that was covering material and rumors associated with that event that were internet specific. Of course, the traditional news media were covering 9/11 and its aftermath, but there were a whole lot of rumors regarding 9/11 that really started and stayed on the internet itself, and the traditional print media weren't picking up on that. And we were sort of tracking all of the online rumors. So that's kind of really where we burst into prominence. But again, as I said, now, what happens on the internet is itself news. Somebody posts something outrageous or, shocking or funny on Facebook, and you know that's news now.
Absolutely is. We're gonna dive into kind of the creation of Snopes, and I mean I've got a whole series of challenges that I've just kind of been thinking about leading up to this. By the way, I've been very excited to talk with you about this, just because I've been such a long time Snopes fan, and it's so timely right now, the importance of what you guys do. All right, we're going to get to that in a second, more with David Mickelson. But first, let's thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation, and that is FreshBooks. You want to set yourself up right, especially right, you know, we're kind of coming out of the tax season. It can be very stressful, right? Set yourself up for next year's tax season with FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. And you do it in advance, next year, it won't be so stressful. Their intuitive dashboard will give you quick access to your spending, outstanding balances, total profit, and other accounting reports, so you'll know how you're doing at any given moment. FreshBooks automatically connects to your bank account and then updates expenses daily, so you're always up to date. And with FreshBooks, you can send professional-looking invoices in seconds, which is nice. You can save time accepting credit cards online. And then, this is the better part, you get paid an average of 2 times faster. Get that money now instead of waiting for it. Accept credit card payments directly from your invoice. You can see what invoices have been sent, viewed, paid, as well as those that are overdue or maybe have outstanding invoice totals. You can create proposals with rich text content, images, customizable sections, all that stuff to customize the look of it. Bill for time by client and maybe also by your specific project. If you have multiple projects going, you can track them independently. FreshBooks recently added Spanish, Dutch, German, and Portuguese languages as options for invoices, estimates, and proposals, so you can effectively reach more people. And with the FreshBooks app, you can stay connected to your clients and keep tabs on your business no matter where you happen to be. You just take a picture of a receipt, you can upload it, and then let FreshBooks do the rest. Super simple. FreshBooks regularly adds new features like team member rates that can now be managed from the My Team page. Also, a new feature, you can add new team members as business partner, basic employee, or contractor, depending on which permissions that you actually want to grant each of those team members. You can set all that up on your own and determine how that goes. From payment reminders to late fees, automate as much or as little as you like and get back to doing what you love. Automation is key for getting back to doing what you love here. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation. Make sure to enter triangulation in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's freshbooks.com/triangulation. We thank FreshBooks for their support. And it's time to jump right back in with David Mickelson. All right, so as far as the beginnings of Snopes, you mentioned that it kind of all started with Usenet. I was a big fan, big, you know, a user in the Usenet forums, but that kind of led to the creation of Urban Legends reference pages. Is that the site that we know now, just named something different?
Yes, exactly. It's just it's kind of an unwieldy name.
Yeah.
But as I said, it was kind of in the early days, the intent was for the site to be about urban legends specifically and kind of be an encyclopedic collection of them, you know, hence that, you know, urban legends reference pages, you know. And I had been known as Snopes on the internet for quite a while before that. That was kind of just a nom de net I adopted because there's like a, you know, 20 million Davids out there. Sure. Who would remember that. So eventually, as I got more technically adept and experienced at setting things up, got the Snopes.com domain name working, and you know, eventually it didn't really change the name of the site. We just stopped calling it the Urban Legends reference pages. And so people started referring to it by its domain name, you know, Snopes.com. We in the early days, we got booted off a number of ISPs for doing too much traffic. Because again, it wasn't a money-making venture in the early days. So we frequently exceeding, you know, traffic and bandwidth limits for the accounts we're paying out of pocket to use. Until
it wasn't a money-making venture, but you obviously had the traffic. at the time? At what point did you kind of realize, like, wait a minute, this is what people hope for. We got to capitalize on this somewhat.
Yeah, well, because initially, I said we just paid out of pocket to do it. We had to pay for the accounts. Eventually, we got discovered online advertising. If I can digress for a moment, it's interesting. When we first got online advertising, I went to the mail one day and picked up the mail, and I opened this envelope, and there was a check for $16 from a return address that I didn't recognize. And I was thinking, who would send me $16 and why? And then I eventually made the connection, oh, that's for the advertising that I put on the site weeks and weeks ago, possibly months ago. And I was just so thrilled. It was like, wow, I actually made money for something that was purely the product of my own creativity, you know, and imagination, and not working for someone else. So things kind of ramped up slowly. It's like, you know, initially, okay, we made enough money to cover the costs of operating the site. Then it was like, okay, a little bit of money beyond that, enough to take a weekend away once every few months or something. And eventually it progressed to the point where, okay, we can now splurge and actually have our own server, run our site on its own server, not get kicked off for doing too much traffic. One case, we got kicked off because we had a category called sex, and the owner of the ISP objected to that.
Right.
So we established things on our own server. Even then, the cost of the server was one thing. Paying for the bandwidth was another.
But you were able to ramp it up, and you had the team to. I mean, I imagine the team was pretty small back then. When you're dealing, you know, especially compared to now, like, what kind of staff did you have? There wasn't the need for a quick turnaround on this stuff, but there was a need to. I mean, it's a lot of writing. You're doing a lot of research. You know, you're having to kind of prove that research, posing links of where you're getting it, proving your work. So it's a lot. I would imagine a decent amount of staff that's needed. Or were you writing all this stuff yourself? Was it consuming all of your time?
You would think, you know, people seem to be under the impression that we had, you know, buildings full of researchers. But no, initially I set up the site, and I literally did everything, which was designing the site, writing the code for the site, managing the servers it ran on, coordinating the advertising, and initially writing all of the content. Then, of course, eventually my then wife, Barbara, started contributing material as well. So for, you know, quite a while, it was kind of like 50-50 in terms of writing material. But, you know, it was more, I was still working a day job until about 2002. And I was also, you know, managing all the technical aspects. So, yeah, we had no technical staff. We had no editorial staff beyond the two of us. And that was pretty much it.
Yeah. And you mentioned Barbara. I had read that you had met Barbara in that discussion group, the Urban Legends discussion group. So obviously Barbara had an interest, a fascination for this stuff as well, which is why she was able to jump in there right as much as she was.
Yes. It's kind of like, again, back in the early days before everything suddenly became available on, well, not suddenly, but, you know, pretty much any kind of research you would want to do these days is mostly available online. Sure. You know, back in the early days, it often meant we spent weekends out at the research library at UCLA, you know, looking up, you know, old newspaper articles on microfilm, you know, sitting on the floor, going through old magazines and books and things. So it was a lot more footwork than it is now. Because we also weren't covering, you know, really current events. Most of what we were writing about tended to be historical, you know, rather than what's taking place today. So that was kind of an evolutionary shift as more people hopped on the internet and it became increasingly real time.
Kind of feels like a lost art, too. Like, I remember, you know, in my days at university, I mean, this was early 90s, but even then there was a high emphasis place. You know, this was really on the precipice of the breakthrough of the internet becoming a public, you know, kind of thing that we take for granted. It really wasn't when I was going to university initially. And I remember doing so much of that, it feels like a lost art. Do you miss that at all? Or are you kind of happy that that's in the past?
It kind of reminds me, I remember when I was in university, they didn't give out internet accounts to everyone. You had to specifically request it and get an instructor to sign off on it. And I remember trying to convince an English instructor at my school to sign off on this because he had no idea what the internet was. So what was he signing? He didn't know. It's like everything else. It's kind of like there was a, you know, most people would not want to give up their cell phones for anything. There's like a romance to the days of, where you were completely out of touch with people unless you, had access to a telephone somewhere, or, way back when you could be at sea for years at a time and be completely out of touch. Yep. So, I miss it to some extent, but I probably don't miss, having to sit with dusty piles of magazines.
Sure. But there's something nice to go back in time and remember what it was like. But yes, we have it a lot easier now. I do remember that actually. What you said reminded me specifically of the fact that in the early days when the internet was first happening, like you said, if you wanted to use that as a source, as a resource plugged into, let's say, a research paper or whatever, a lot of times they wouldn't accept it because it was the easy way to go. It's like, no, you didn't go through the proper channels. The proper channels is the library, and you go in there, and this is how you do it. But
I did have an amusing incident several years ago because I continued to take online classes long after I got my degree. And there was one class, it was government and politics. It was politics and religion. I think we had to write a term paper, and the instructor gave me a zero, claiming that I had plagiarized Snopes, not realizing who I was.
Wait a minute. Yeah, I'm the author of that article. Yeah.
It was very difficult to write anything about politics and religion, as you can imagine, that did not echo something I had previously written that was out there on the internet. Even worse, it was a case where, as often happens, another site had taken one of our articles and reproduced it without permission. And he accused me of plagiarizing that article.
I'm sure that has not been the only case of something like that happening. Some questions about the business in general, about this idea that, you've now run a business for about 24 years whose sole purpose is to take what could be myths, what might not be myths, and say whether it's true, whether it's partially true, false, whatever. How does Snopes, as an organization, how do you determine whether something is even Snopeable or not? Like, I mean, you have to make that decision, right? That this is worth our time and this is not. How is that decision made?
Correct. Well, in general, we use the same standard we've used for a very long time, which is we tackle whatever the most people are asking about or questioning at any given time. How we determine that has shifted. Before, we could pretty much just look at our email or look at what search terms people are entering into our search engine. Now we also have to take into account, what are people posting on Twitter? What are they posting on Facebook? What are they talking about on Reddit, what's trending on Google, all of those things. But although the metrics change, the general principle doesn't. Just if people are asking about it, we tackle it. We don't make any judgment about that's too frivolous, that's too obvious, that's too ridiculous. There are other sites like ours that focus solely on politics, and there are other sites like ours that don't do politics but do other things. And we've always been kind of the broadest in subject matter. So that's the standard we use. It is sometimes depressing to see what the audience is most interested in. As I said, it's like there's a perfect example right now, a chemical attack in Syria. People are questioning, did that attack happen? Was it actually the government that perpetrated the attack? Was it someone else attempting to blame it on the government? Was it a foreign power? That gets, a little bit of interest. A fake news story about did a woman really give birth to a litter of kittens in an elevator, millions of page views. So, it's like Syria, people might care if something happened there, made gasoline prices spike to $8 a gallon tomorrow. But otherwise, it's, you know, pictures of Donald Trump supposedly experiencing a diarrhea attack on a golf course or, you know, ridiculous fake news. That's where the audience goes.
And I mean, the importance is placed less on this is a story that we really need to debunk, and more on this is a story that people are sharing, whether they realize it's whether they actually believe it to be true or not. It's being shared a lot, so we must represent it.
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of a slippery slope, especially where politics is in the mix, if we started choosing what to tackle based on how important we deemed it to be rather than the audience. And I suppose it says something possibly about the world that if people are questioning, truly questioning whether a story about a woman giving birth to a litter of kittens is real, maybe it is important that we tackle that, you know.
Yeah.
Rather than...
I mean, and that's one of the questions that I definitely have for you, especially right now. But I'm sure this has been a challenge for quite some time. But you feel it a lot now, is this kind of this wavering belief or feeling about. On one side, you have misinformation. On the other side, you have satire. And we've always been okay with the fact that satire exists, and it's part of living in a country that, you know, with the First Amendment, you know, free speech and all that kind of stuff. We're free to have satire. But then, you know, there's also this kind of concurrent movement of, well, but yeah, misinformation is dangerous to our democracy. And it's almost like they're at odds with each other. That's got to be a challenge for you guys. But I guess maybe it isn't, because you're agnostic to all of those forces. It's just, is this true or is it not? Let's find the answer because people are sharing it.
Well, true, although... Again, it seems at times it does seem a bit frivolous when you're having to debunk something that to a lot of people is an obvious joke or is obvious humor. We've always had occasionally gotten satire submitted to us, people asking, is this true? And of course, it was a lot more likely for that happen in the early days of the web, where, again, people would cut and paste text from an article and mail it to their friends, and people were seeing it completely divorced from its source. And you can't always blame people for questioning satire, because after all, really good satire hews that fine line between believability and ridiculousness. I mean, that's kind of the point of satire, to poke fun at something that is real by using an example that should be ridiculous. Of course, one of the problems now is that the more and more people that pile on the internet, the more really bad satire you have. Also, there are a whole lot of people out there who are sort of using the excuse that they're, you know, producing satire when it's not by any stretch of the imagination satire. They're just engaging in political trolling, which is really the equivalent of ringing doorbells and running away. It's just ha-ha, fooled you kind of thing. You were dumb enough to fall for it. That's not what satire is about. It's about making a point about social or political issues and doing so in a way that is arch or pointed or funny, not just, you know, hey, put out a fake news article that says, you know, Donald Trump died of a heart attack, and haha, we're satirizing the people that believe this. You know, that's not satire. So,
yeah. I feel like, when you're talking about kind of the troll mentality, I mean, when I think back, you know, to internet, even in the 90s, like, trolls existed then, but now it's like a force. It's like a dominant force that actually, you know, has real world consequence.
Well, yeah, and again, it's like everything, like, so the curve works this way for everything. At least back in the early days, it really took a fair amount of time and investment in effort and money to actually get a good-looking website up, something that, you know, looked professional. So if you were going to try and troll by pretending you were a news agency, you really needed some investment in that. But now, hey, you know, spend whatever, $50, get yourself a nice WordPress template, set it up, you know, doesn't cost a whole lot to host it, boom, there you go. And, you know, you're now almost on equal footing with the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN or anybody else. You got something really slick and professional looking, and, you know.
We also
the way we consume now news now is sort of divorced from its brand in a sense, that in this, you know, people don't really go to CNN and read all the stories there, or go to the New York Times main page and read all the stories there. You're typically being exposed to articles from a whole lot of different sources, either because you're seeing them on your Facebook news feed or you're going to maybe the Google News main page. But, you know, you're not doing the equivalent of picking up a newspaper and reading it from cover to cover anymore. It's kind of like, you know, somebody went through a clipping service and clipped out articles from 100 different periodicals and threw them all in a box for you to look at. And, you know, you're not really necessarily aware of where these articles came from. You know, they don't have a coherent source behind them. So it, you know, makes it a lot easier for bad actors, so to say, to slip into that news stream.
Yeah, and you're talking about the sites as well. I mean, it's super easy to look legitimate, which is, you know, and on one hand, it's a pretty interesting and amazing testament to how easy it is to build for the web compared to probably what you encountered when you were first starting Snopes back in the day. Building a web page was really not that easy at all over the years. And now it's super easy to make something that looks professional, legitimate, and so much so that it's confusing to almost everybody to know whether something is in fact legitimate or not. And that's just a sign of the times of where we seem to be right now. And it's got to make things a little more difficult for you. One of the questions that I had about how Snopes sources this stuff. I mean, at what level is a source required to kind of achieve? What is the level that they have to achieve in order to be considered a valid source as evidence for a claim, for or against a claim?
Well, that's tough to answer broadly, especially because, you know, what we tackle varies so much in scope. And obviously the sources you would use for determining whether a given photograph were real or not are going to be different than, you know, a claim about, oh, does this bill that's before the California Assembly, you know, will it really make owning dogs illegal or something? We do and have to do a lot more footwork these days in the sense of actually tracking down the people involved in things, trying to get information from them. Again, back in the early days, it was often somebody's emailing something on the internet. It's like no way of knowing where that thing came from. Nowadays, since most things are being disseminated by social media posts, rather than anonymous email forwards, it's a lot easier to try and trace that trail back, you know, find out where things came from, find out, you know, whom we need to contact, there's a lot less anonymous material out there. That makes tracking down.
That makes a lot of sense. Like that has me wondering, like what the origins of the Nigerian prince scandal or the Nigerian prince scam, which I mean, I'm assuming is, you know, one of the early kind of hallmark examples of the type of thing that Snopes debunks.
In fact, that's an example. One of those things that always kind of amuses and perplexes me, like the Nigerian scam or other things more recently, where it's kind of like suddenly they start circulating widely and, you know, thousands and thousands of people are hitting our site all at once to look at this same thing that we debunked 10, 12, 15 years ago. And it's perplexing. It's like, first of all, why do those things suddenly reappear out of the blue, sometimes after having been dormant for years? Yeah. And secondly, it's like with the Nigerian thing, how are there people on the internet still who have not already seen this before? You know, where did they come from? You know, do they log on to AOL once 25 years ago and not since? Or, you know,
or do they keep receiving this, never once question and go, man, there are so many Nigerian princes that need my help. I think I'll finally help them.
Yeah. I'm hearing it from 12 different princes. There must be something to this. You know?
I mean, the crazy thing there is if it's still happening, that means that somebody's probably still making money. There are some people that are probably still falling for this. But that is an interesting question, why some myths persist. And I'm sure there are plenty of myths that die off completely. You know, what is it about those myths that persist? And I imagine with that as the example, that's a myth that has some sort of incentive, some sort of value for the person that receives it, depending on what their life is at that moment, their condition. You know, there are a lot of desperate people in this world that are just looking for their luck to turn into a positive direction. And sometimes that particular email, as strange as it may sound, is the message that they were hoping for.
Well, true. Some of what drives that, of course, is what's going on in the world at any given time. I mean, we used to kid about even if we were cut off from all outside news, we could tell what was going on in the world just by reading our inbox. Because, you know, when people are anxious about certain things, suddenly we see this large influx of recirculated pieces having to do with, you know, immigrants and immigration. Of course, after every mass shooting, there's a recirculation of pieces having to do with, you know, guns and gun control, you know, on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. It's, you know, a hallmark that, you know, urban legends in general and, you know, the kinds of things we cover in a broader sense tend to be driven by fear, in a large sense. They speak to people's anxieties, what they're concerned about, things that posit a personal danger, you know, something that is about a subject that, you know, something that could be dangerous to you personally, to your children, to your family, to your pets. So those are the kinds of things that tend to drive the most traffic, at any given time. So, you know, it doesn't take much to try and get them recirculated, you know, rumors about human trafficking. We see periodically, they often tied to cycles of when, say, summer's coming on, you know, kids are leaving school, maybe looking to take on jobs or other activities, so it's to a large extent driven by what goes on in the world. It's an unfortunate aspect of what we do that so much of our traffic is tied to terrorist attacks, natural disasters, political upheaval, presidential elections, which shouldn't really fall into those other categories. But
here we are.
they've been as contentious as a lot of things can be lately.
Absolutely. And in some ways it's been it's been the red line that separates the Snopes of the past, which was, you know, largely a site that you go to because you heard that funny, weird myth, to the Snopes of the future, which we could talk about in a second because I really want to get into this world that we're in now. We talk about it all the time, the era of fake news, and there's a lot to get into there, especially with Snopes working with Facebook, to kind of help them debunk some of the stuff that's shared on the network. Let's talk about that in a moment. Before we do, let's thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. And that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's awesome if you happen to be hiring. Every business needs great people, and you probably already know that. But even more important, is you need a better way to actually find them. If you can't find them, then what's the point? Something better than just posting your job online or, you know, hoping that the right people see it at the right time. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. They're finding those candidates for you so you can do the things that make you money, and then you can dive into the people that you know are worth your time. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply for your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. I can hardly believe that it only takes a day to do this, but that's the beauty of ZipRecruiter. they find these the right people and put them in touch with you. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications that you receive. So you might get a stack of applications that are qualified and then find that these are the best so that you never miss the great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. That's ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. One more time for good measure, ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. And now it's time to talk about, well, an exhausting topic, to be honest, this world of fake news and not being able to really trust what we see, which is the foundation of what Snopes is all about. All right, so the most important kind of phase that we're in right now in technology news cycle and journalism and politics, I mean, it's all pointing to this idea of how easy our technology is to kind of shape, form, fit, manipulate, to misinform. And that kind of seems to, thankfully Snopes is there, although I don't know if you were super happy to have to take on this gargantuan challenge, which is to be one of the very few companies online who's dedicated to really proving that some of these highly charged news stories, these claims, all this stuff that's happening in the politics space right now is true or false. So, fake news is a big deal. Back in 2012, kind of prior to all the fake news stuff, factcheck.org quoted you as saying you'd be hard-pressed to find two more apolitical people. Of course, you were talking about you and your then-wife, Barbara Mikkelson. Has the era of fake news changed that for you?
Well, I'll tell you an amusing anecdote. It was one of my hobbies in my increasingly vanishing free time is board gaming.
Yes.
So there was a fellow in one of my board gaming groups about the same age as me, who a pediatrician, who was telling me one day about how his father, who was then in his 80s, was getting increasingly enmeshed in Fox News and kept sending him links to all these stories about Barack Obama was born in Kenya and he's a radical Muslim who attended a madrasa. And so my friend would send his father back links to Snopes patiently. And he said one day his father replied and said, "Well, why should we trust them? I mean, you don't know what their agenda is. You don't know who they are." So he replied to his father, "Well, Dad, actually, I do know who they are. I've been over to their house and they're not really very political." So, yes. So, prior to doing this, politics was not really an interest of mine at all. It really only became it to the extent of, having to be up on it to do what we do. But I had never and still have not, worked for a political campaign, advocated on behalf of any candidate, not meaning the extent of sticking a sign in my front yard or putting a bumper sticker on my car. I have never donated to a political party or campaign or candidate, despite people's attempts to try and claim that we have, but no.
Well, you mentioned that's one of the things that we've kind of heard in the past, or rather that people, have charged or questioned, is this idea of bias on the side and, are you left-leaning or right-leaning? And I mean, what you're saying today is that you kind of, you approach the problem, you don't necessarily, it sounds like, approach it from either side, but how do you well, I guess if you're making both sides angry, then you're probably doing it right, right?
Well, it was sort of an interesting phenomenon that for a very long time, probably, 90-95% of the political stuff we were coming across in the wild, so to speak, on the internet was anti-liberal, anti-democratic for whatever reasons we could only guess at. And it's really only within the last, 4 years or so, I'd say 4 to 6 years, kind of like the other side has caught up and where it's now kind of evenly divided between, the two sides attacking each other. So for a very long time, 90% of what we were writing about was, anti-liberal, anti-democratic, and it's kind of a hallmark that, 90% of what we're writing about tends to be outright false, if not grossly exaggerated, no matter who it originated with. So it kind of created that perception that, well, all you're doing is taking stuff about liberals and saying it's false, so you're already obviously liberal, but that just happened to be the nature of the material. I mean, sure. Now we have, Occupy Democrats and a whole lot of other, left-leaning sites and, Facebook groups out there that are competing in the political arena. So, it's a pretty evenly mixed bag now.
Yeah, it feels that way. Back in 2014, the company, you really seemed to kind of ramp up staffing. You kind of became, I don't know if serious, but more serious of a destination is the right way to put it. But in hindsight, in retrospect, you were perfectly poised in many ways to kind of handle that onslaught of the 2016 election craziness that happened and everything beyond. Was that future thinking? Was there any sort of, kind of looking forward and realizing like, we're entering a strange time now where facts and, fake news, I don't know. Did you see that coming? Is that what that was? Because that seemed really timely, really good decision.
I like to claim that much foresight. But really, sort of around 2014, my former wife had stopped contributing to the site. So I was literally doing everything myself, all the aspects of running it along with 100% of the content. And it's just like, I would like to have some other life someday.
Sure.
So, that's when it started taking on, additional writers hired from outside. It wasn't at that time that I foresaw, there's going to be this whole rise of fake news and, contentious presidency. It was kind of sort of coincidentally right around that time, sort of the middle of 2014, that fake news became a thing in the very limited sense that we were originally using fake news, which was people setting up sites just to spread ridiculous stories, kind of like Onion-esque stories, but, without any hint that they were, actually fictional. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, a woman gives birth to a litter of kittens. I mean, not stuff that was political in nature and not stuff that was specifically intended to try and influence politics, but just, publishing stuff intended to fool people. That kind of hit really big back then. And then it was just sort of tied into as things progressed in politics and, the presidential campaign started ramping up, which always bring their share of misinformation. But now we had, I said, other actors involved, people outside the U.S. even trying to, depending on whom you believe, either just make money or actually influence the election or some of both, feeding into that stream of just flooding us with misinformation and, also misinformation intended to pit, sides against each other. I didn't really see that. It was like, I'd also like to claim that, 25 years ago, I saw that, fake news and misinformation, that's going to be one of the biggest challenges of the 21st century. So I'm setting myself up to do that now.
But I'm going to make my bet now and I'll look like a genius. Well, yes. I mean, it's a good thing that you were there. Obviously, a lot of this looking back in recent, very recent history seems to have come in large part from Facebook, or rather Facebook is seeming to feel a lot of the heat. And as a result, recently, this was probably about a year and a half ago, Facebook enlisted Snopes to help identifying fake news on its platform. Kind of checking in on how that's working. How did that come to be and how is that going right now? How has that relationship been?
Yeah, well, of course, we're not the only one. I mean, they enlisted us, but, the other fact-checking organizations. it's mostly, at least now, it's a, you know, platform for just to help Facebook match up our fact checks and other partners' fact checks with, you know, material that's being on posted on Facebook. I mean, really, our involvement ends at writing articles and, you know, just sort of identifying in a database what they match up to. Of course, we don't have any control with what Facebook does with them. And, you know, they've shifted their approach as the process has evolved. You know, some initially, you know, if we or other fact checkers were rating something false, they would kind of display a warning to users that a particular article was disputed and provide links to corrective information that is fact checks. I think they found that process didn't work so well. It was more effective if you just sort of provided additional links and didn't tell or suggest to people that they were wrong or reading something that was wrong. Just try and provide more gentle guidance. You know, Facebook also now, I guess, is actually using ratings to limit the reach of material on Facebook. Like if you have multiple fact check partners saying an article is false, then that will actually result in fewer people on Facebook seeing that article, at least organically, as they call it. But, you know, a lot of the underlying mechanism is a black box to us because that's all controlled by Facebook. Sure. So, you know, in general, like I said, the process still works is we and others write fact checks. You know, we create entries in a database to help Facebook match them up with what's being posted. And then Facebook uses that information in some way to help curb the spread of misinformation on Facebook. You know, it's going to, and it is evolving. You know, up until now, it's been pretty limited to just fact checking articles, you know, actual web articles. But of course, misinformation spreads through other means as well, through memes, you know, through things that could be posted on other social media platforms, you know, through just pasting text, you know, into Facebook. So yeah, it's a process of working out, you know, fake photos. That's a whole other thing.
Well, yeah, not only fake photos. This was another thing that I wanted to ask you about. Now we're seeing this very new trend of fake videos where artificial intelligence is being married, you know, and neural networks are being trained so that you can take a video and you can make. I mean, at this point, it's still possible to look at it and see that there's some digital manipulation going on. But you can see that it's at this point right now where a couple of years and it's going to be super convincing. Yes. How are you guys equipped to deal with that? Because that takes a whole other level of skill.
Yes. In fact, I will take credit for that is something I have seen coming for quite a while, which was there are a number of techniques to use in identifying fake fake videos and fake photos. But, you know, of course, one of the easier approaches was that most people had to base them on something. It was very difficult and time consuming to create a convincing fake completely from scratch. So for the most part, people were taking, an existing photo and an existing video and manipulating it. And so it was generally usually possible to try and, you know, match that up to the original and show, well, no, you know, somebody digitally altered this. You know, this isn't a real photo, this isn't a real video. But, you know, I've seen a long time coming as those tools progress, it will become easier and easier to create that kind of material from scratch where there's nothing to match it to. You can, you know, probably start with just one or two, say, photos of President Trump, you know, run it through software, get it to animate his features, put audio into his mouth that match up with the lip movements. And, you know, it's going to be, you know, unless there's some kind of rigorous, you know, like time stamping, you know, code embedded in those that can't be tampered with, it's, you know, it's going to be difficult.
I mean, it'll have to, you know, some of the sourcing will have to be, and you can do this now on some of the early videos that I've seen that are doing this, you know, you're going to have to source
kind of the video, the background video, not the lips, but the actual, like I've saw one with Obama, and you know, it's definitely a presidential address, but it looks so convincing. Yeah. But
yes,
it's very possible to go back at the source and match the head movements and know, but that's just a whole other level of complexity for people working at Snopes to prove that.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Not easy.
Then, absent any technological solution, then you just have to go back to absence of evidence, which is, of course, pretty much everything, say, a president would say, publicly these days is recorded, either audio, video, transcribed, whatever. But, you know, just for the average person who is not on camera every waking moment of the day, that's going to be difficult to prove what's true and what's not. I mean, I hope there are technological solutions coming down the pike that I don't have the ability to foresee, or it will be difficult for us. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, because I know we're running out of time here, just a couple of things I wanted to ask you about. First of all, the Repository of Lost Legends. Really wanted to get this in here. The acronym, by the way, if you're not following closely, is TROLL. But this was an interesting experiment in something called False Authority Syndrome. And I think what's interesting about this is people really, a lot of times want to believe what they want to believe, and that's becoming a challenge nowadays. What do you think about that? I mean, it was also in my reading a way to kind of take the edge off of the people working at Snopes, that everything isn't quite so serious. But will there be a resurgence of this, of the Repository of Lost Legends? And I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I'd say you could call it sort of the precursor of fake news, because the idea was exactly that, sort of like, can I take a completely ridiculous premise and just claim it's true and write it up so authoritatively, and by the virtue of it being on our site, would people believe it? And so I started out with probably the most infamous one, about the idea that Mr. Ed of television fame was not actually a horse. He was a zebra. And I came up with this whole contrived explanation of how, because the show was in black and white, that in the early days, people wouldn't have been able to tell a horse from a zebra on their black and white TVs. And it was really amusing. One day I was in a line at a grocery store waiting to check out and scanning the tabloids that they keep, right by the checkout counter for suggestive selling purposes. And I looked at this one tabloid, I think it was the Star or something, and I see this headline that says, "Shocking truth revealed, Mr. Ed was a zebra." And they ran this whole, double spread story about Mr. Ed being a zebra. And they went and tracked down Alan Young, the star of the series, to ask him about it, because they didn't talk to me or even reference our site. But
but they heard through the grapevine, and that's good enough for us, apparently.
It's one of those, it's one I enjoy, because when people ask about it, it's something I can pinpoint the source to the exact person and date and time it was created.
Except for the possibility that Mr. Ed was a zebra. In that case, you just knew something before everybody else knew it.
Yes.
Interesting stuff. And then finally, I wanted to ask you, before we kind of wrap things up, about kind of this ownership thing. Last year, Snopes held a crowdfunding campaign to hashtag Save Snopes. You can still look that up on Twitter if you like. What are some of these challenges that you face with proper media? I know I saw an update that went out, I think it was last month, that the Superior Court entered a judgment in your favor, actually dismissed the causes of action coming from proper media. So where does that leave Snopes as far as the ownership is concerned? And is there a way that people can still help out if needed? You did pretty well in the crowdfunding campaign prior.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's distressing that we had essentially a vendor we contracted with to provide web development and advertising took umbrage at our canceling the contract with them and decided to respond by holding the site hostage and essentially stealing all of our revenue for months on end. The problem is that even though with our legal system, even though you are absolutely in the right, it takes a tremendous amount of time and money to chase things through the legal system. You know, it takes years and years to bring something to trial, if it's not settled beforehand. So it's made it difficult. I mean, first, I said we literally were about to run out of money and had to shut down until we started the GoFundMe effort. And it's still distressing that we have to spend so much money on legal fees chasing after the money that was taken from us. Mm-hmm. But we're charging ahead, getting by for the time being, hoping to explore other ways of generating revenue. Online advertising is a tough market for everyone. We have the GoFundMe. It's still active. We still appreciate anyone who can supporting our efforts by donating to it. And, we're hoping we're coming up with additional funding methods in the near future.
Sure. Sure. Good. Because it would be a shame to lose Snopes at this point. It's the now more than ever, man.
It won't go away. It could come down to me doing it all by myself again.
Hey, you've been there before. You know how this rodeo goes. So let's see here. We're kind of at the end of the interview. So I guess what would you say lies ahead for Snopes? Are there things that you haven't yet done with the site that you'd like to accomplish at this point? Or the importance of the site seems so elevated now versus 10 years ago. That's got to be an interesting place to be. What's next?
There's a lot of things. Just my personal preference, of course, we kind of got away from what we were doing in the beginning that was, fun and entertaining and colorful. It's all kind of focused on politics right now because that's where everyone is focused. But, I kind of miss the days when we were, writing about, music and, movie legends and things that, were more personal interest of mine, and having a lot more fun rather than having to be deathly serious because all of this is about vitally important politics and we've got to make sure we get every aspect of it right. So of course, we hope to expand our operations, expand our team, expand the type of media that we're using. I mean, we're still, a web-based entity. I mean, there are lots of other media out there. There's podcasts, there's television, there's book publishing, so
a lot of other directions that you can go.
Media out there that we haven't even imagined yet.
Absolutely.
I can't take the foresight of claiming everything. It's also kind of ancillary to our function, but it would be nice to expand into actually trying to improve the world by making people better thinkers, getting involved in efforts to teach critical thinking in schools. I always have to realize again when I speak to audiences that I grew up in an era of you got your news from three television networks and the local newspaper. And, I'm talking to people now who, have always gotten their news from social media. They don't have that experience with what the news media used to be like. They sort of entered the field when it was this whole tangle of fake news people and real news people and all looking alike and all being 24/7, and narrow casting on cable networks that can cater to one particular end of the political spectrum. So it's a very different landscape than when I started. And, I have to keep in mind that, these people didn't experience the world the same way I did. They have different cognitive abilities and different cognitive, processes. Because it's a very different world, and we want to be helping them to navigate their way through the world.
Yeah, their sense of normalcy as far as getting this news and this information is far different from our experience. Doesn't mean it's better. Doesn't mean it's worse. It's different, and it all evolves. And and hopefully we'll continue to see Snopes evolve with it. And I think that we will. And I really appreciate your time today. Thank you for taking an hour out of your busy schedule to sit down and talk with me, because I've had a lot of fun, David. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. David Mickelson, Snopes.com. Check it out if you haven't. If you haven't, I'd be really surprised ever. But if you haven't lately, go back there. I was having a ton of fun before we connected with you doing the random function and trying to guess whether things were false or true. And it's just, I love your site. I'm a huge fan. So
thank you.
Thank you, David, for hopping on. And we wish you the best of luck with Snopes going forward. Appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Sure.
We record this show every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern at twit.tv/tri, or you can go to twit.tv/triangulation, and you can find all of our episodes that we've recorded. This would be episode 343. So we've got a lot of episodes in the back catalog. If you haven't checked them out, lots of fascinating discussions with people like David Mickelson today. twit.tv/tri. If you want to catch us live, like I said, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, just go to twit.tv/live, or go to the show page if you can't catch it live. That's twit.tv/TRI. I may have got those twisted up, and if so, I apologize. But it's Friday, and it's time to get to the weekend. I'm Jason Howell. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Carson, our producer. And we'll see you next week on another episode of Triangulation. Bye, everybody.